We come to the last book of the poetical section of the Bible. You have the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, known as the Law. You've got the historical books. There were 12 of the historical books, and then we came to these five poetical books, and the fifth one here is Song of Solomon. Now, each one of the poetical books in the Bible actually covers a major question in life. Job, of course, covers, you know, why suffering? Psalms talks about how to worship and how do you relate with God. Proverbs speaks so often about what is wisdom and how do you relate with others. And then Ecclesiastes, what is the chief good? What is the most important thing in our lives? And Solomon tastes everything in the world and comes to the conclusion, okay, it's God. Fearing God, putting Him first in your life, that is the chief good. And now we come to Song of Solomon. And the question is asked or answered in a sense, what is love? How does God love us? How does He want us to love each other? And in particular, Song of Solomon becomes it's actually a very controversial book because it is very explicit in language about marital love. And in such is the case, some have tried to get away from the explicit nature of that and kind of treat it as an allegory of God's love for the nation Israel. Some have treated it as an allegory of Christ and His love for His bride, the church. But in a sense, as it is literally, and if you just take the literal interpretation of as we approach the scriptures, it's really a manual for lovemaking in a marriage. The language, the idioms in Hebrew are very explicit, does not come out that clear in the English, and that's okay because we don't want to go beyond a PG rating this morning. But it is something that does express this picture of God's design. Now, God created sex. He created love. He created the intimacy that He wants a husband and wife to have together. And one thing we have to remember is, even though this is a historical picture and a record of a relationship that Solomon had, most likely, with the Shunammite woman, and that God brought them together, and of course, it had to have been in his early years. Certainly was not indicative of his relationships with women later as he accumulated 700 wives. So he missed the boat as he did in the area of accumulating gold and accumulating horses, the three things that kings were not supposed to do. So Solomon backslid, we know that. But in the early years, it is a picture of his being a shepherd in the field, seeing this woman, being drawn to her, attracted to her, and it goes through the courtship stage and then the intimate stage within marriage. And it's a beautiful, beautiful picture. But having said that, we would be very much mistaken if we approach this book without seeing Jesus. Remember, Jesus said to his disciples in the road to Emmaus, all those things pertaining, you know, in the Old Testament pertain to Him. And He told the Pharisees, you search the scriptures, for in them you think you'll find eternal life. And these are they which testify of me. You can't read through the Old Testament without finding Jesus on almost every page. The aspect, He is the preeminent one, the one whom the Lord has raised up in these last days, and He is our Lord and God, and He is our Savior. But He, of course, is the one that really is typified in this. Now again, the actual use of this book is probably to be something that encourages husbands and wives to really enjoy each other and to come together in that intimacy which God intended. You know, the Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5 says the marriage bed is undefiled, but adulterers and fornicators God will judge. Now, what does that mean? You know, again, it's another way the translators being very careful with their language to not be too explicit. But the word bed is the Greek word coitus, and we get the word coitus. It's the interchange between husband and wife in a marriage bed. And that is undefiled. That is God's design. This is where He made it. So we're going to see a number of pictures of love here in this particular book, and especially in this first chapter. We're going to see some of these things, but we can't forget that this is all about marriage. And remember, marriage is simply a mystery of that union of husband and wife coming together, becoming one flesh. It's a picture of a greater relationship. The relationship that you have with your God, the relationship Jesus has with the church. So he begins the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's, wherein we get the title of this book, the Song of Solomon. Some of the translations have the title of this Canticles, which is the Latin word meaning songs. But here is the Song of Songs, the superlative song, the best of songs. It's a love song. It's actually an opera, if you will, a play in which the various parts are speaking and, you know, the drama unfolds. There's a lot about the attraction phase and the courtship phase. And again, even to the explicit lovemaking aspect. You know, my wife had already made me promise not embarrassing her going through this book. But I want every, you know, young person to know. And if you're a parent here and you have your young kids with you, don't feel like you got to cover their ears with this stuff. Because in a way, most likely they've heard already, you know. And unfortunately, they've heard in the wrong direction about sex and love and that sort of thing. But here is something that God has designed and He wants us to know. And He's put it here in the Bible. Some even argue with that. How could this be in the Bible? Well, God is the one that designed that. Even the rabbis felt that this book shouldn't be read by any Jewish male until he reached the age of 30. That was just how well they understood those Jewish idioms and the Hebrew idioms that were in this. But, you know, as I was reading some of this to Karen and going through some of these phrases, she was like, you know, she's saying, this book is going to affect you, isn't it? And I said, well, I have to practice what I preach, don't I? I mean, I'm a pastor. I can see her now. She's in the back. She's mad at me. She's like all embarrassed. But you know what? We ought not to be, as Christians, prudish about love at all. We ought not to be treating even the eros, which is the Greek word, the Hebrew equivalent is here. But the Greek word eros is that word from which we get the word erotic. And we ought not to be considering eroticism as something that the world has made it. They've turned it into lust. And that's not what it is. There's something much deeper to the erotic love that God intended. And the world has perverted it and twisted it. And hence you have sexually active young people and teenage experimentation and AIDS and unwanted pregnancies and abortions and sexual addictions and all kinds of weird perversions out there in the world. It's sad to say that they've misunderstood what God had intended for erotic love. And in fact, they have a cheap imitation, just lust. It's not the real thing. They don't understand it. And as Christians, we ought not to think in terms of, well, God's love is the agape love, and that's the worldly love. No. God made eros. He made it. And it's like a warm fire, but you don't take that fire and put it outside of the home and outside of the marriage relationship, else it will burn your house. And you'll get burned by it, and it won't be the real thing. Well, it opens up, verse 2, very quickly. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Now, there's a little play on words here in the Hebrew, actually. The word kiss and the word wine have the phonetic sound that's very similar. And so the Hebrews would have just related that poetically. The idea there, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, of course, it's speaking of intimacy, a yearning on her part for this one to come into her life. So here's the attraction stage, the stage where she's longing for his presence. She's longing for him. And this particular word in Hebrew, of course, is the eros word. She is longing for that deeper relationship with him, but she's, of course, in a position where she has to be dependent upon him taking the initiative. And here it is right here where she speaks about his love. Now, the love word is in this phrase is eros. The next word that we're going to find is actually the equivalent of agape. But let's see how that unfolds. He says, because of the fragrance of your ointments, your name is ointment poured forth. Therefore, the virgins love you. Draw me away. So again, see her dependency upon him taking that initiative. Now, it's important to realize that as she expresses this, we can look at this very clearly as the desire and the longing for that intimacy, which God has put in all of us. But you could also relate this around to our need and our desire ultimately for our King, our Lord. Because even as we have that human relationship as husband and wife, and if you're single again, this is just as important as well to realize the foundation of where eros fits. God intends us to have an intimacy with him. Jesus is altogether lovely. So many of the pictures and emblems of who Jesus is is actually taken out of the Song of Solomon. There are many of the phrases, many of the songs that we sing, many of the hymns that have been expressed have come from the pages here, realizing that God is the one behind such beautiful, intimate love. In fact, even to the point where she speaks about his fragrance. Now, how does your lover smell? You know, I mean, she's, of course, very entranced by his fragrance, his ointments. Therefore, she says, the virgins love you. Everybody loves you, but draw me away. She's looking for a specific commitment on his part toward her. And the daughters of Jerusalem. Now, when you see the various divisions here in capitals in your Bible, like where it says the daughters of Jerusalem, that's been added later by the translators to make some sense of the dialogue that's going on. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're not right. This could be just as well her saying, we will run after you. In other words, you're attracting everybody. We're all coming after you. But then you find that commitment comes. Notice, the king has brought me into his chambers. Out of all the virgins, out of all those, he chose me. And then, of course, the daughters of Jerusalem with a little bit of jealousy there. Well, we'll be glad and rejoice in you. We'll remember your love more than wine. You know, we'll remember that picture of it. But now this woman is chosen. And the Shulamite responds rightly, do they love you? On this phrase, love here, and when it says, we will remember your love and rightly do they love you, this is a word that now becomes the foundation word. Now, what's really fun sometimes in looking at certain words, especially in the Hebrew language, is to realize the richness of that language. We have certain sounds that come together. Of course, our alphabet is devised in order to form words, and the words have conceptual meanings. In the Hebrew, it's a pictorial language as well as a conceptual language. It's both. Like in Egyptian language, you've got the hieroglyphics and the little pictures tell the story and the word kind of comes from the story and it all fits together in the whole meaning. The Hebrew language is not far from that in its original form. In fact, if you take the letter Aleph, which is the first letter, it is the first of the letters. It's the beginning. Then you've got the word Bet, which is the second. We get our alphabet from Aleph Bet. But in that word, in that letter Bet, the original cuneiform actually was a little triangle with a foundation on the top. And of course, that is the word Beth is a word for house. When Bet Shen, when we go to Bet Shan in Israel, that's the house of Shan. You've got this picture of this word, this little triangle, little home, you see it, and it means house. Later, our language, we turned it sideways and it became our modern B. But let's just take that word for example. Now, the Hebrew language, they kind of fit things together. When you have alpha or aleph and you put bet together, you've got the first word in the Hebrew, which is Abba, which is what? Father. We sing the song, Abba, Father. It's a word that, if you think about it, you've got the first letter and the first in the house. So naturally, you've got Father. They form the letters to tell a picture. So you've got the first in the house, which is the father. Now, what's cool about this word love is the equivalent to agape is aheb in the Hebrew. And it takes the aleph and the bet on the other side, and it's got in between those two, in between, in the house, where the leader of the house, the very word ha is put in, or the letter ha is put in between them, and that is actually in flying. Of course, ha is the sound, is the word for breath. It's the word for essence. It implies the very essence of things, the breath of God. So now the word love in the Hebrew is formed with the father in the center of it with the H. Now you've got the essence of the father, you know, is love. So you see how the Hebrew, it's a beautiful language to learn. I know a little just from the little bit of study that I've done, but I would love to pick up a lot more of it just because as I get into some of these studies, I think, wow, what a rich language to learn. But this reminds me of now that she's coming to a place where she's speaking about her desire for that erotic love. As God has put in all of us, he's made us sexual beings. But she understands that the foundation of that is agape. Now, here's where it gets very interesting for us as Christians. We tend to think of agape as the highest form of love, the end, the goal. Oh, I just want to reach agape. And that's actually mistaken. It's not the goal. It's the foundation from which you have to start. It's not the end result, it's the beginning. Agape is the foundation love because it's commitment love. It's why we begin a marriage with a marriage vow. I vow to be, you know, till death do us part, your partner. I am committed to you. Now, you don't know what kind of feelings you're going to have a year from now, 10 years from now. You don't know what's going to happen in the marriage, what situations will come up. You know, will you love them anymore or feel love, I should say. The point is, you're making a commitment to love. There's the foundation. That's what agape is. It's committed love. God so loved the world. He was so committed for the best of the world. That was his commitment to us. So much so that he gave up his only begotten son. God examples this, models this love for us. But unfortunately, so many people do not understand this is the foundation. They think love is a special way of feeling. And it's a conditional love. I love you as long as you're this or that. Or I love you because you're beautiful, because you're this. But if those qualities are no longer there, then the love falters. No, this is the foundation. You're committed. And let me tell you something. Only on that foundation can now the erotic love be formed. In fact, it even goes like this. You've got the foundation in agape. Then you build phileo. Phileo is the Greek word for friendship love, give and take love. You like each other's presence. You know, in a marriage so often, you know, you get to a point where you hate each other. You're committed, you're staying there, but you don't like each other. You're not building on that foundation with that friendship, give and take love. You've somehow come to a place where now you're married, you have to stop. You can stop trying to win each other. Well, I find for myself that I can't look at the fact that I won my wife back in 1980 and we said I do and it was done and that's it. Okay, you know, we're married. No, it doesn't stop there. I'm continuing to win her. I've got to continue to make myself presentable. I've got to continue to woo her. Isn't this what the Lord does for us? He shows us that foundation of agape. But then he says to the disciples, you're my friends, that phileo love, if you do whatever I command you. There's a lot of Christians that have experienced his agape, his committed, self-sacrificial love to them, but they're not really growing in a friendship with God. They're not really growing in obedience. They're not really growing and enjoying the presence of God. It's like, well, I'm a Christian and I go to church and, you know, I believe God loves me and we can recite our creed, but it's not a real relationship. That's a missing ingredient in our relationship. It should be friendship. Abraham was called the friend of God. Because he trusted God and he obeyed him. Trusting and obeying. You're building on that phileo. Now in a marriage, very similar. There's that give and take. There's that trust. There's that yielding to each other. There's that pleasing each other, but also being pleased by each other. Allowing your partner to please you and building that friendship. And then you have on top of that, it's kind of the frosting on the cake. I look at agape like the roots of the plant. Digging down deep, getting firm and established. And then you've got the stalks of the plant, which is the phileo, the green, and it's life, and it's exciting. But then you've got the flowers of the plant, which is that erotic love, that beautiful love. But it can only bloom in that strong foundation. So she says, rightly, do they love you? And she understands that foundation. In verse 5, she goes, I am dark but lovely. O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Do not look upon me because I am dark, because the sun has tanned me. Now, of course, the term dark that's often used in the Bible for the skin color never actually ever referred to a race. It was referring, of course, to the sun and tanning her out, being in the sun. And notice why. She says, my mother's sons were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept. In other words, I was forced in an unfortunate situation to serve out in the fields, and the sun then just totally ruined my skin and tanned me. Of course, in our day, that would be a cool thing. Ooh, nice tan. But in that day, you know, it wasn't a cool thing. But despite that imperfection, she was naturally beautiful and lovely. And so she says, I'm dark, I've been tanned, but I'm still beautiful. My mother's sons were angry with me. Now you see a little bit of the hint there that, does it remind you a little bit of a story? The half-brothers making her do all the bad work, and yet there's a Prince Charming out there waiting. This is a little Cinderella story. It's exactly what it is. She's out there in the fields, and somewhere along the line, of course, she runs into this shepherd. Now, early in Solomon's years, we can only speculate. Maybe David wanted him to experience not just a silver spoon in his mouth for being the king's son, but maybe a little bit of what life was all about. And David grew up as a shepherd, so he put Solomon out in the fields to tend some sheep, to learn what life is all about. And Solomon's out there, kind of incognito and secret, and you know, he sees her and he's entranced by her. And then when the final thing unfolds, you know, he becomes king and he's in his authority and he comes after her. It's kind of the Cinderella story. But she says to this, she says, "Tell me, O you whom I love, where do you feed your flock? Where you make it rest at noon? For why should I be as one who veils herself by the flocks of your companions?" In other words, I'm trying to find you and I can't. And you're putting me in a position where I would have to be like one of those women who veils themselves by the side of the road, which would have been equivalent to a prostitute. And I don't want to be prostituting myself. I don't want to be putting myself in that position. So she's asking where he can be found. And he responds, "If you do not know, O fairest among women." Now stop there for a moment. How does he see her? Not her imperfections, but he sees the beauty. You know, this is something that I think we as husbands need to learn constantly, how we talk to our wives, how we treat them, how we honor them and respect them and build them up and encourage them and praise them. God made them to experience that, and they respond to that. But we're often tight-lipped. You know, we're like the guy who his wife wants constantly for him to say, "I love you," to her, and she keeps asking, "Do you love me? Do you love me?" And he says, "Look, I told you when I got married I loved you. If it changes, I'll let you know." That's how a lot of men are, you know. And they think that's really romantic. No, that you need to speak it often. But, you know, think about this. Let's put the twist on this of the Lord toward us. Does he not look at us as pure and undefiled? As we've come to him and received the sacrifice of his own blood for our lives and we've received the forgiveness of sins, despite our imperfections, the Lord looks at us as pure and beautiful. Isn't that amazing? Now he tells her how to find him. She's looking for him. How do I find you? How do I know where to go? Don't make me in a position where it's uncomfortable. But notice, he says, "Follow in the footsteps of the flock and feed your little goats beside the shepherd's tents." So he's indicating to her how he can be found, which I think the Lord does that constantly. You know, I think if we woke up in the morning and we put first things first, we'd open the scriptures and we let the Lord speak to us, he would be found of us. He's shown us where we can find him. He's shown us, he's instructed us, but we rarely take advantage of that. And then he says, "I've compared you, my love, to my filly among Pharaoh's chariots." Now again, a Hebrew idiom here of, which it doesn't come out the same in the English. I don't think you're going to get a lot of mileage, guys, out of comparing your wife to a horse. I wouldn't advise doing that. She might compare you to a certain part of the horse's anatomy, but I wouldn't advise doing that. You know, this is, but this in this language, this is extremely picturesque. There's a picture of all the stallions, you know, hot to trot out there, and they're all looking for a mare, you know. Then there's this treasure, the filly, the most beautiful one, the prize. And that's how he looks at her. Do you look at your bride as a prize? As a young man, I was very impressed with an older couple in the church back in California. They had to be in their 70s. And he would refer to her as his bride, even in their 70s. And you know, that instructed me a lot as a young married man. I said, you know what? This is where I'm going. This is where I want to be. I want to be where he is, you know, at that age. And I want to have that love for my wife and see the beauty in her even when we're old and wrinkly. Because that doesn't matter. Because it's much deeper than that. And so he sees, you know, "I've compared you, my love, to my filly among the Pharaoh's chariots. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold." Then you have the little rephrase there of, "We will make you ornaments of gold with studs of silver, the daughters of Jerusalem." And the Shulamite responds, "While the king is at his table, my spikenard sends forth its fragrance." So she's taken the time to, you know, put the best smell on. In fact, she describes in verse 13, "A bundle of myrrh is my beloved to me that lies all night between my breasts. you know, she's comparing him to this bundle of myrrh. Now, that would have been a common way for the women in those days to smell good, is to have a little bundle of very fragrant ointment or perfume around their neck, kind of a little necklace. In that culture especially, it would have been important because, you know, we typically, with modern conveniences, have showers and baths once a day. You know, I hope you do have your shower and bath once a day anyway. There's no excuse not to in this culture for the most part. Although sometimes, you know, when I go to a restaurant and a waiter comes by and I go, whoa. You know, I've had that experience a few times in New York City and I think, man, are these guys homeless and then coming to work? Because obviously they're not taking care of themselves in this way. Well, in that culture it would have been a little more difficult. Even just up into maybe 100 years ago, it was considered that, you know, you wouldn't have a bath every day. That would be an extravagant waste. In fact, for a long time, typically it was Saturday night was bath night in this country and some of the European countries. You know, you get all cleaned up to go to church on Sunday morning. And then you start your work on Monday and pretty much get pretty ripe by the end of the week. Saturday was a great day, you know. But in that culture, of course, they wouldn't have had those conveniences, so the overwhelming perfumes would have been very important. And she certainly wants to smell good, but she's actually referring to him as that fragrance. Now, that's important. Because, you know, to me, a relationship is all about being better. It's all about helping each other to be better. You know, when I was thinking about marriage as a young Christian on fire for the Lord, I didn't even want to consider it if it wasn't going to help me in my walk and if I wasn't going to be able to help someone else in their walk with the Lord, because that was the ultimate goal for me. And I'll tell you, when you meet a godly woman who is good for your soul and is all the other things combined, there's nothing like it. You know, there's nothing like a godly woman who's going to do good for your soul. But here, she's experienced the fact that he is to her that fragrance, that she's blessed, she's refreshed, she's encouraged by his presence. She's encouraged so much so as it's a beautiful smell. In verse 14, she goes, "My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blooms in the vineyards of En-Gedi." Henna blooms smell very much like roses and are very much popular in Israel. In fact, when you go to En-Gedi, you've got to picture this idiom that she's using here. Why En-Gedi, as opposed to other places? Why would that be so significant? When we take our trip down to the Dead Sea region, when we go to Israel, we leave the hotel and we go over the Mount of Olives, and then we go down this very steep road to get down to where Jericho is. Then we take a right, and you go down along the Dead Sea. And the Dead Sea is on your left, and on your right, up these kind of a mountainous terrain, is the wilderness of Judea. It would have been the same area that Jesus would have been out there for 40 days and 40 nights tempted. Now, when you think of wilderness, you might think of, like, you know, rivers and trees and forests and just out there in the wilderness. But in the wilderness of Judea, try to picture not a single blade of grass growing. Try to picture a bleak desert, more than any desert we have. We don't even have a desert in this country that can even equate with it. Our deserts are green. They've got lots of cactuses and cacti and all kinds of other plants and, you know, cat claws. And my relatives lived out in the desert, and I used to love going out there, but there was so much wildlife and so many quails come through. Out there in the Judean wilderness, nothing. I mean, it's bleak. But as you keep driving, up on the right, you'll notice a little tiny little bit of green patch. And you'll wonder what that is until you park the car there and you'll start walking up. You'll go through the ticket counter and you'll go up into this wildlife refuge. And eventually you'll see all these trees and pretty soon all these reeds and plants. And it's a tropical environment up there in En-Gedi. Well, because the springs of En-Gedi have flown for thousands and thousands of years, it's grown up, it's beautiful. Well, just up in the hills, you see nothing, desert. All the animals come down, you know, to drink. It's a beautiful place. But this is how she's referencing this one. "You are to me, my beloved is to me a cluster of henna blooms, the most beautiful, the most fragrant of all the blooms in the middle of the desert." There in En-Gedi, in the vineyards of En-Gedi, nothing else growing, and there's this bloom. When you make a commitment to someone in a relationship, and you let that commitment be the foundation, you'll find that you really grow to appreciate each other. You grow to understand each other. And, you know, the more you build together, the more your friendship grows. And here you find that same experience. Now, again, it's the same type of relationship that the Bible references, that marriage is a mystery. It's a reference to Christ and the church. God created the whole thing. He created intimacy. He created all of this about sex and love as a picture of his desire to have intimacy with us. Of course, God is spirit. That intimacy it's a different thing than just the physical. It's an intimacy with the Lord that where we are appreciating him on a level that nothing else matters. And no matter what's going on in our life, no matter what desert is around us, there is a sweetness of his presence. This is how she refers to him. And of course, his response, "Beloved, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes." Now, you could go with the idiom on doves in a number of ways. Doves, they do happen to be interesting birds because they mate for life. If one of the mates of a dove dies, the other one will not mate. That'll be it. They mate for life. They stay together for life. And there's that commitment. And she goes, "You're fair, my love. Behold, you're fair. You have dove's eyes." There's he can see the fidelity. He can see the trust. He can see that all that within her beloved. And notice what the Shulamite says. "Behold, you are handsome, my beloved. Yes, pleasant. Also, our bed is green. And the beams of our houses are cedar and our rafters of fir." Now, again, this may not be the type of poetic language that's going to move your wife, you know, or your husband. But in that day, what is being expressed here comes back to that which is the foundation for any type of love in a marriage relationship, and that is commitment. See, there is the commitment here. The beams of our houses are cedar and the rafters are of fir. The idea, there's a stability, there's a solidness here. I mean, you look at where people are going today with their marriage vows. What does it mean nowadays? You know, they're actually having conditions put in the marriage vow. You know, little outs that they can have. Some are actually terminating the contract after 10 years, and then they'll renew it if they feel that it still fits there where they are together. There is no understanding of real commitment. And I can tell you, with that type of conditional love, they're really never going to enjoy the erotic love that God intended for a marriage. It'll only be a cheap imitation because there's no beams of rafters of fir and beams of cedar, no stability, no foundation there that's been built. God established marriage, the first institution he ever established. Before any other government, any other thing ever came into being, he established the family unit where a husband leaves his father and mother, which is very important. You leave that. You know, your wife is not your mama, guys. You got to get out of that thinking. And you cleave unto your wife, and the two become one flesh. As a young man, I remember a wise old man giving me that counsel. You know, he says, "There's two things I want you to remember, Lloyd." He says, "Number one, life is tough." Understand that. Life is tough. Don't think it's going to be easy, because if you expect it to be easy, you're going to always be whining and complaining and struggling. And, you know, just understand it's going to be tough. That way, when it's easy, you'll enjoy it. And when it's tough, you'll expect it. He says, "And the next thing I want you to remember," and he said, "your wife is not your mama." Now, I wasn't married at the time, but he wanted me to know that when I got married, I wasn't getting a mother. I wasn't getting someone to take care of me and to meet my every needs. And now, you know, it was my mama did. But rather, I'm getting a partner, a companion, and a friend. And two very strong and wise pieces of advice. I'll tell you, I'd wager you, if we had this type of commitment in our marriages, what a different world we'd live in. If we understood the commitment the Lord made toward us when he sent his son, we'd also have a different world. We would see so much of God's love toward us. We would respond to it like the Shulamite does to Solomon's love here. She's excited. She's anticipating this, the romance of it, the excitement of it. And really, the Lord wants us to enjoy him. But it can only be on that commitment. You know, this is a story I've used before about a real situation that happened with a lady who's very frustrated. This story could be repeated many, many, many times around the world. It's in our society, in our towns. This woman had it with her husband. She was so upset. After 15 years of marriage, she was ready to call it quits. She couldn't take any more. She'd had it with him. He was insensitive. He didn't take care of her needs. He never thought of her, and she just couldn't take it anymore. And she was complaining to one of her Christian friends about just, you know, I know divorce is wrong, but I just can't take it. And if I could get away with it, I'd kill him. You know, I mean, she's just very upset. Well, her Christian friend understood a little bit about their relationship and gave her a piece of advice that was quite interesting. Said, you know what you need to do? Do you really want to hurt him? Do you really want to get back at him? Oh, yes, she said. She says, why don't you do this? For the next 30 days, treat him like a king. Make all of his favorite meals. Reduce all the stress around the home. Don't get in any arguments about anything. Just make it a nice atmosphere. You know, dress beautiful. Look beautiful for him. Even in the morning when he leaves for work, look like you're ready to go out in the town. Everything he needs, just cater to his every whim and fancy and desire, and do everything you can for 30 days. And at the end of 30 days, look him in the eye and say, I want a divorce. It'll crush him. She goes, oh, I like that. So she began to do that. Christian friend called her in 30 days and said, so, how's it going? Now, she understood a little bit about human nature. She anticipated that it wouldn't turn into what, you know, the other woman thought it was going to be. And she says, how's it going? Did you tell him you want the divorce? And she goes, divorce? Are you crazy? We are madly in love with each other. And she began to describe how, you know, he'd responded, and, you know, now he began treating her. But more than that, as she started treating him that way, her affections followed. You see, where your treasure is, your heart will follow. Where you put your time and your attention, your heart will follow. This is why guys that start flirting around with ladies at the office, their heart starts following, and the next thing you know, they're like an ox led to the slaughter. And they don't know what's going to cost their life. And then we come home and we just expect everything to be just nice, and we don't have to say anything nice to our wives. You know, it's how you doing? Okay, fine. We don't talk to them. We think that it's just, we're married. So that's the way it is. So we put no investment into that. And guess what? Your heart doesn't follow because you're not putting your treasure there. But when she started putting her treasure, her heart started following. And then he started responding until eventually they had a beautiful relationship out of a marriage that was ready to dissolve. Now, I begin to wager that there are some marriages in this church that are quite sick. That your foundation is real shaky. You're not quite sure whether you even care about the foundation anymore. Much less, there's no friendship and very little, if any, eroticism in the marriage. You know, I want to encourage you. Come back to the foundation. Start building there. Start being toward that person what you're supposed to be, despite whether there's any response at all. Be what you're supposed to be, because that will be before God, and that will honor him, and he'll honor that. And just see what might happen. See, marriage isn't 50-50. That's the world's deception. That's baloney. Marriage is 100-100. If you're not given 100%, even if your partner is not given 100%, it doesn't matter. You're not given 100%, then you're not honoring the Lord in that relationship. Honor the Lord with that. Be committed. Get the beams of cedar and the rafters of fir settled there so it's a foundation. And then you're going to see that friendship. And then you'll see that other aspect of ministering to each other. And this, the same thing applies to your walk with God. There's a lot of half-hearted people in walking with God these days, and they wonder why they don't really enjoy the fruits of the Spirit. They don't enjoy the love, the joy, the peace, the patience, the kindness, the goodness, the faithfulness, the gentleness, and the self-control. They wonder why others have that experience, but they don't. Because, quite honestly, the foundation hasn't been laid. You haven't been committed. You haven't been fully consecrated to Him. You haven't said, I do to the Lord, meaning that you don't to anything else. You still got a lot of idols in your heart, things that have taken your heart and attention and time, and your treasure has followed, it's put into other things, and your heart has followed other things, and your heart is cold toward the Lord now. You need to come back to that first love, that first joy, and that first experience. Return to your first love and restore that joy of your salvation and see what the Lord might do.